This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast is sponsored by IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print in the July-August issue. You can learn more about that magazine at www.computer.org/security. This podcast is the second in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm very pleased to have with me today Dr. Dan Gier. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Dan is the chief scientist at Veritasys. He lives currently in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Dan's a pioneer of security as risk management, Microsoft gadfly. He has a PhD in biostatistics from Harvard, and all sorts of other fun things. You've been doing this for a long time.
Yes.
So, Dan,
one has to admit that, but yes.
You were among the first security gurus to talk about risk and to try to elevate the discourse, which had been, to that point, technical, to the business level. Do you think that that's become common sense yet?
It doesn't mean the practice is good, but it's certainly been accepted. I once got to hear one of Stu Feldman's lectures. He used to run part of Bell Labs, and he gave these talks on technical maturity, and he said 5-point scale, and you can do it with one hand. You had a good idea. You could actually make it run. You could get a gullible friend of yours to try it. People stopped asking you why you were doing this. Other people were asked why they weren't doing it. And the risk management thing, I think we're to the point where people no longer ask you why you're doing it, and I think we're almost to other people get asked why they're not.
That's great. So it's taken a while to make that amount of progress, I
guess. Yeah, it has.
What do you think was the thing that pushed it over the edge into more commonplace understanding?
Well, sadly, it's partly fear, uncertainty, and doubt, certainly the fear aspect. But it's also, I think, that it's fair to say that information assets and all the stuff that all the computers and networks and so forth we buy to handle them, but information assets, I believe, are now increasing in value faster than the companies which hold them, or putting it differently, the percentage of total corporate wealth that is information is rising. And as such, we've probably crossed some threshold. I couldn't put my finger on it, but we've probably crossed some threshold where people say, you know, I've got to pay attention to this. This is part of the corporate wealth. This is a contribution to our stock value. It's, you know, however you want to express it. But I believe we became economically important enough that we couldn't be ignored anymore.
I think that's right. One of the side effects of that is that the first generation of security executives, I'm especially thinking about in New York in the finance houses, had risen through the ranks of the IT shops and tended to be technical guys who may not have much of an understanding of business. And most of those guys have been replaced these days by executives who do have an understanding of business.
Right. These days, I find titles like technology risk management. I would never have found a title like that 5 years ago, as opposed to what 5 years ago I might have found someone who reports to the CIO whose worries are security. And then you get a information security officer. But you wouldn't have found someone whose title was risk management.
Right.
You just wouldn't have.
So one of the challenges, I guess, that we face as a discipline is that in order to be a good security practitioner these days, you have to both understand technology very deeply and also be able to understand the business context. Do you think that makes it an impossible field?
No, I think it makes it a fabulous field. I mean, this is the Renaissance man, so called, is someone who knew several fields. It's a wonderful thing to be able to bridge one of those divides. Certainly, you know, I've said this before, and so some people may have heard it, but we're at a moment in this field, in the, say, the information computer, whatever you want to call it, security field, where the number of the leaders in it who actually had training in some other discipline before they adopted this one is as high as it ever will be. We'll be replaced by people who actually got education in security. None of us who are the first round did, and at the moment, we can borrow from other fields their skills and practices and history far more efficiently than we'll ever be able to do again, and that kind of hybrid vigor, if I can call it that, it's a wonderful time to be in this field. Absolutely wonderful time.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. It's kind of interesting to note that your background originally was in biostatistics, and mine is in cognitive science, for example.
Right. And who would have thought?
Yeah, who would have thought?
And then I can say for mine, and you can say for yours, for mine, decision-making with important consequences in the face of uncertainty and bias, not a bad training for security.
So let's switch gears a little bit. Your paper, Cyber Insecurity, the Cost of Monopoly, caused a seemingly well-orchestrated splash. And the question is, did you accomplish what you wanted to accomplish with that paper?
Well, I don't think people have changed much. So if you wanted to affect change, I don't know that we've had much change, though I think it's fair to say there is an acceptance across the board that having everything just alike is a dangerous trade-off. On the one hand, everything just alike gives you the maximum ability to manage it, because it, you know, if you don't have only one species to manage, they're all alike. And on the other hand, of course, everything just alike is the highest level of danger. And I believe that there's a common acceptance that that is true. What is not accepted all around is, and which way should you make that trade-off?
Right.
Because to have everything alike on the grounds that it's easy to manage does allow you to harden systems. But my personal belief is that the word harden in this case means harden like brittle.
Yeah, like good old-fashioned AI is hard.
Sure.
And brittle.
Versus harden in the sense of tough, which I think you get from diversity. Mm-hmm. And certainly in the academic world, there are people looking at how do you manufacture artificial diversity out of what is otherwise, shall we say, a field of cloned computers.
Well, do you think that market pressures tend to enforce or erode diversity?
I think they tend to erode diversity in this when it's a commodity. How many companies are there that make a PVC pipe, for example? And the answer is a very small number. On the other hand, when it is not a commodity, I don't think the market actually enforces monoculture. I think it's the other way around. So one could say that, to pick on Microsoft, actually, their great trick was somehow or other to make their operating system be appreciated as a commodity and yet at the same time escape the commodity pricing pressures that ordinarily go with that.
Right, right. Do you think that the open source movement is then, in some sense, correcting the market? Was that an emergent phenomenon that was destined to occur?
Yeah, I think it's destined to occur, and I think it's not going away, and I think that if anything, the pressure on interoperability in particular is one that supports the open standard, the open source, open standard side, because interoperability, well, in some sense, what did those of us who were present at the start of the Internet and at the beginning of the Internet Engineering Task Force and all that, the only thing we ever really wanted was interoperability.
Right.
And so that very pressure for do the things at least talk to each other, I think does counteract the monoculture question quite a lot, because if we were to standardize in the sort of physical, in the operational sense, not in the sense of the formal written standards. We were standardizing, this is how things talk to each other, and it doesn't matter what's at the other end, and furthermore, there's lots of suppliers. We're much better off than if the only way you can get two things to talk to each other is if you buy them both from the same guy.
Right. So, since we've already hopped into the Wayback Machine, I did want to ask you about your previous life, which involved work on Project Athena. And I wondered how that work influenced your thinking about computer security.
Well, the wonderful thing about having been in Athena, besides the fact we were early enough that we could have all sorts of problems without someone else overtaking us from behind just because we were having them. We could have everybody else's problems first, so to speak. The other wonderful thing was, because it was at MIT, our student body being what it is, for example, if I wanted to test something, I could merely announce that it was impregnable, and testers would come out of the woodwork whether I wanted it or not. You know, you can't break this. Well, you know, people would show up.
That happened to Larry, too, when he said Oracle was perfectly secure.
Yeah, I don't think he was planning as much as we were. We were doing it cold-heartedly.
See, you did it first.
Yeah, we did it first. But what it did influence me was the idea that obscurity doesn't help. For example, we literally published the root password to all of our desktops. And the argument was, the reason we do this is to discourage people from thinking there's a challenge to breaking into them.
Hmm.
You know, the password, for what it's worth, was Mr. Root. And it was roughly like if you've ever bought, say, a small piece of consumer electronics, like even a hairdryer, and it says, right next to where the right next to the Phillips head screws, it says no user serviceable parts inside. That's all we were trying to do. You know, yeah, you can break this thing open. It won't do you any good because, you know, just type the password, help yourself.
Right.
And so, but instead, what we put effort into was recovery from whatever people did to the machines.
Hmm.
And there's a bank in New York. I can't name them, unfortunately, but I suspect they're not alone because the banks, of course, all copy each other. And they have decided that from this point forward, none of their investment security will be around making failure less likely. All of it, instead, will be around making failure less meaningful. They, in other words, are going for mean time to repair equals zero, rather than mean time between failure equals infinity.
So that reminds me of really how we approach bank robbery today. Instead of trying to stop people from robbing the bank, we want to make sure that we catch them as soon as
sure,
they
you give
do
them
it.
A die pack.
Which is an interesting tactic, I suppose, that works somewhat.
Mm-hmm. You give them a die pack. You record some serial numbers before they go out the door. You have a special bag of money for when the robber comes, when we know all the serial numbers, or something. You know, you do something like that. That idea of suppressing mean time to failure, mean time between failure, is important. But at some point, it becomes more cost-effective to decrease mean time to repair. You know, availability is time between failures divided by the sum of time between failures and time to repair. You can get availability to one either by making the time between failures infinite or making the time to repair zero.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Either way.
So they're two knobs.
They're two knobs.
And we should be looking at both.
And if you only handle one of them, you're missing the point. You're spending more money or you're underprotecting. Those are your choices then.
Right. So you wrote the foreword to my new book, and I owe you a big thanks for that. Thanks.
No, you're entirely welcome.
And the interesting thing is you wrote my favorite sentence in the whole book. So I didn't write my favorite sentence in the whole book, and it goes something like this. You said, as Dr. McGraw reminds us, breaking something is easier than designing something that cannot be broken, though I personally prefer Sam Rayburn's earthy formulation, viz., any jackass can kick down a barn, but it takes a good carpenter to build one.
I'm glad you like that.
So let's talk about software security and whether or not you hold out hope for this emerging discipline. I know you were very, very active when you were the CTO of At Stake in helping to cut new ice in the field. So what do you think about what's going on in that subfield?
Well, I suspect we are in violent agreement that security is, if not a proper subset, a hugely overlapping subset with quality. That security faults are as unintentional as any kind of quality fault, and that the techniques and measurement strategies and skills that go into making things that don't break are highly relevant to the software security question. I've been thinking a lot about this, and I don't know that I've got this right, but let me try two ideas on you. One is, a piece of software is a security product if it has sentient opponents, is the first idea.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I mean only if you have someone who's trying to break it, is it a security product. If the only thing that breaks it is alpha particles or bad luck or what have you, it's not a security product. But if someone is, and so many things that aren't ordinarily thought of as security products fall in that category.
Yeah, so it sort of hinges on intention, like much of the law.
Yeah, it hinges on intention. And the other is that what makes security around software so different than everything else is time. In other words, how fast does the clock tick?
Hmm.
I'm fairly convinced that with software we need to adopt not so much the status, the style in which, say, law enforcement or the military works, which is, if you do something bad, we will get you. But rather more like what the intelligence agencies do, which is that preemption requires intelligence and intelligence requires surveillance. In other words, the software has to, in some sense, watch itself. And those who build it have to watch it. And there has to be a willingness to observe, whether that's automated or by people or whatever. It just doesn't happen automatically. You have to have your eyes open.
So I buy that, but I think it opens up the privacy can of worms in quite literally a very dangerous way.
Oh, it does. It does. I wasn't saying in every circumstance surveillance in the broadest possible sense.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of software security in and of itself, in a way, I'm suggesting that software has to be watched. whether that is in the design process with design reviews and with outside analysis, whether it's in the configuration, which I think is where an awful lot of failures occur, is field configuration. We have to have tools for looking to see, does this make sense?
Mm-hmm.
In its actual operation, noticing when something is taken advantage of. These days, as far as I can tell, for example, the state of the art is code injection into running processes, no attempt to put a payload on the disk.
Right.
Don't care whether it survives a reboot, because you'll always be able to inject it again.
That's right, yep.
And so this idea of you have to watch it, you have to look at it, you have to have a kind of inspection viewpoint, as opposed to, again, like law enforcement or the military, if you cross that line, we'll get even.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that at all. Your opponent can strike from anywhere with no warning to you, and as such, you have to be watching. And again, that's whether that's watching in operation or whether it's watching in construction. And of course, as you would know better than I, nobody writes anything substantial from scratch anymore. Everything is hundreds of libraries you inherit from, in some sense, you don't know where.
Right, so your code is always wobbling on top quite a large pile of software.
Exactly.
So recently you've turned your attention to data security, and I wanted to know why you think that's the next big thing.
Well, I can't be certain it's the next best thing, but like anybody else, I make bets from time to time. The bet here is based on two things. One, and I sort of spoke to this earlier, I think that corporate information is becoming more valuable, relatively speaking, than other things. Grace Hopper, for heaven's sakes. Now we're talking 35 years ago, 40 years ago.
I met Grace Hopper.
Oh, did you?
Great
well, fabulous.
Woman, yeah.
Fabulous. You will know then that she said, someday on corporate balance sheets it will list information because it is more valuable than the machines which contain it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is now. I think, you know, if I steal a laptop out of your car, there is no company in the country that will be harmed by the cost of a stolen laptop. But there are an awful lot, and you can read the newspaper every day, that are harmed by the, well, now what was on that laptop?
Right, so the example du jour is the VA who lost some millions of identities of people.
Yeah.
And all it was a laptop that was stolen.
Yeah, it was a laptop stolen out of a house. I mean, for heaven's sakes, you know?
Yeah.
So there, on the one hand, there's no shortage of proof that the value of the information is rising faster than the value of the other things sort of wrapped around it, whether it's computers or companies or whatever.
I think you once said some striking figure about the growth of data over time.
Well, that was the other thing I was going to say, actually, was that, and I can't be, this is all back of the envelope roughness, don't get me wrong about this, but if you look at our friend Moore's Law, it's been doubling every 18 months in horsepower per dollar for a while, and some people say it's slowing down and some say it's not, but anyway, let me say for the moment, let's suppose it stays constant. That's an 18-month doubling in what you get for a dollar. Storage prices are doubling for what you get for a dollar faster than that, like 12 months. And bandwidth prices in the laboratory, not necessarily what you can buy from Verizon, say, but laboratory anyway, is doubling every 9 or so. If you get 18, 12, and 9 for doubling times, and you carry it 10 years in advance, you do get two orders of magnitude for CPU, but you get 3 for storage, and you get 4 for bandwidth. That tells me that there's no doubt the future is more data-rich in terms of volume, and yet, despite that volume growth, it's more in motion.
So that worries me a little bit, because we have trouble describing policy of data just sitting around.
True.
And we're producing more and more, and that sort of awful grid of access control stuff, our good old Bell and LePadua model, just isn't going to work.
If you look at there's a wonderful website that when he was still at Stanford, still at Berkeley, that Hal Varian put together, called How Much Information. And it hasn't been updated in 3 years because Hal is now, I think, chief economist for Google. But in any case, at that point, the estimate was total information produced per person on the planet. And we're, of course, including a great number of people who live on a dollar a day.
Mm-hmm.
Total information per person per year, 800 megabytes.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm right about doubling times, it's way above that now.
Right.
That's an awful lot of information.
Yep.
And if I wanted to do something mean, you know, if my job was to go cause some havoc, I got asked this the other day on a panel, so here's what I'll say, and, you know, I hope I don't give anybody an idea they didn't already have. I'd write a little something or other that, for example, took Excel spreadsheets and fiddled a small number of the numbers in them by a little bit.
Yep.
all the time, forever, and was passed along to the next guy.
Well, for a while, the Intel chips did that.
Yeah, sure, fair enough. just a little bit here and there. Just bit rot, if you want to call it that.
Right.
Now, you tell me how long before, instead of 5,000 copies of the budget, you have 5,000 things, each of which is an approximation of a file you no longer have, what that will do to you.
Right.
So I think, in other words, back to the point about why am I working on data security, I'm sort of betting that the other problems are, while by no means solved, pale in comparison to the theft, misappropriation, poisoning, whatever term you want to use, around data, because certainly our acquisition, retention, and processing of it are continuing to rise in amazing ways when you really think about it historically. What other products double in their price performance every 18 months, much less 12 or 9? Nothing except computing. So let's assume for the moment that all of that value is now as at risk tomorrow as it was today, mm-hmm. and just multiply it by the volume alone.
Yeah, the risk is obviously increasing.
Right.
So one last question. You and I are probably the only two computer security guys who raise hogs. And so the question is, how many do you have going now?
At this very moment, none, because the smokehouse is full.
I see.
New things will be happening soon. Call me back on that one.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. The July-August issue of IEEE S&P Magazine will feature a print version of this interview. In addition, the issue features articles on web-based software security, web services, and VoIP vulnerabilities. Subscribe to IEEE S&P today at URL www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. For show notes, links, and online discussion, see the URL www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.